Welcome to Focal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. Right now we're having as a guest again Dr. Paul Kanger of Grove City College. He's a best-selling author. His most recent book is called Takedown, and it actually traces the Marxist roots to the assault on the traditional family. And this interview is being actually recorded on the very day that the U.S. Supreme Court has decided 5-4 that same-sex marriage will now be the law of the land for all 50 states, regardless of how the millions and millions of Americans who oppose it feel. Paul, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Jerry.
So I feel like, in a sense, we're no longer living in a constitutional republic, in a sense, as far as the court is concerned.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I would argue, too, that it's hard to argue that we're still living in a Christian nation. It's certainly one founded on Judeo-Christian roots. I mean, we are a nation founded in Judeo-Christian roots, but we're quickly severing our ties there, too. In fact, I would say that we're more similar to where we were at the Garden of Eden when it was first proclaimed, ye shall be as gods.
Yeah.
Because June 26, 2015, five members of the Supreme Court proclaimed themselves gods. They rendered unto themselves an extraordinary ability that heretofore was reserved for the laws of nature and nature's God, and that is the right to define marriage. So it's an incredibly arrogant, incredibly bold move, never been done before. And, it's an extraordinary. And any libertarians who are arguing for gay marriage, you're out of your mind. I mean, you just gave the federal government a power that before was the province of nature and God. This is an amazing day. It is the start of a period of long religious persecution to come, unfortunately, and it's also the start of a long period of numerous, uncountable, repeated redefinitions and new configurations and new manifestations of what we used to call marriage.
You mean you don't think it'll just stop here?
No, it's impossible. It can't stop here. I mean, when you've taken the model mold that says male-female marriage, and when you take it and you smash it so it's no longer just one man and one woman, and your standard, which is the standard of the same-sex marriage advocates, that adults who love each other ought to have the right to marry each other, then, what's to stop the redefinition? And I'll tell you one thing that's coming next that same-sex marriage supporters are already saying. In fact, there's a group called the Beyond Marriage Campaign. I talk about them in the book.
Oh.
And, they've already been arguing that same-sex marriage is just the first step to being able to redefine marriage. But you'll read a lot of gay advocates out there are talking about how the type of marriage they want here is going to be monogamish. So I think that in many cases, same-sex marriage is already going to spawn another form of marriage, and that is non-monogamous marriage. So the fundamental transformation has begun.
Well, it's interesting. I've done a lot of interviews with former homosexuals, people who, through the power of the gospel, have been set free from that particular sin. And by the way, some have gone back into it, unfortunately, but there are those who've stuck with it. And as I often say, I know some ex-smokers, but that doesn't mean nobody can quit and be happy that they did. Anyway, bottom line is, every one of them, especially the men, have told me that promiscuity is an inherent part of the homosexual lifestyle. That is not necessarily true on the lesbian side of the equation. But as far as men, even if they, quote-unquote, get married, it's almost a guarantee that it's an open marriage, so to speak.
That's right. Yeah, and in fact, you can read, there's a very good piece by Jonathan Last in the Weekly Standard, which usually doesn't hit this topic. And some of these gay couples are talking about their monogamish form of marriage, which will include at least one-time-a-year flings that are permissible within the marital bond. And by the way, to take this back a hundred some years, a guy by the name of Friedrich Engels was arguing for non-monogamous marriage. although he was arguing on the case of heterosexuals.
Friedrich Engels, as in Marx's co-writer.
That's right. And the 60s radicals on the new left, the cultural Marxists, their slogan, remember, Jerry, was smashing monogamy. They were creating colonies in places like the Red Family in Berkeley, which included Tom Hayden and Robert Scheer. They were creating forms of new marriage that included non-monogamous marriage. So all of this stuff has precursors, antecedents, and, you know, again, which is why you have to understand the ideological history of all of this, because it doesn't just happen one morning where you wake up and you redefine marriage. Ground had to be plowed to get to where we are. And the atheistic, agnostic, radical left, which rejects natural, traditional, biblical marriage, has been plowing this ground for a long time.
Well, you know, it's interesting how the plowing has been very effective. Obviously, it's gone up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the court has said, at least by a majority now, that this is the law of the land for all 50 states. And yet, even still, there have been people around who say, hey, you know, if two gays want to get married, who cares? So what? Why does it impact me? So why does it impact anybody else?
Well, yeah, it impacts society on so many different ways. I mean, for one thing, you know, everybody knows. I mean, liberals and conservatives in the 1990s, finally, we all came together. We argued how essential it was for a child to have both a mother and a father. I quote in the start of this book a beautiful Father's Day speech by a fellow named Barack Obama in June 2007, when he was a senator, talking about the importance of fathers at home. Well, and liberals all agreed with that. Well, that being the case, why are liberals now absolutely hell-bent on creating a new form of marriage that excludes fathers? And that's what female-female marriages will be. And in fact, conversely, they're hell-bent on creating a new form of marriage that will ban mothers.
Yeah.
Because that's what male-male marriage is going to be. Right. So why would they suddenly get into these ideological contortions that go against their own common sense and what's best for the family?
Yeah.
Easy. Ideology. Their wedding, their marriage, if you will, to gay marriage has forced them to once again go against nature, go against biblical law and natural law, and go against common sense and experience. They've sort of lost their minds on that.
You know, there was an unreported aspect in all the flurry of friend of the court briefs that were being filed and so forth. But one story that wasn't well told, unfortunately, but there were children of same-sex families who spoke out and said, this stinks. We don't like it. It is a terrible deprivation to a child, and we should know because we grew up with this. But the court obviously didn't listen to that, or the majority didn't.
No, that's right. And they don't even, the court doesn't even have enough sociological data to look at the impact on these children to be able to go into this. I mean, you would think before you embark on a grand social experiment that's never been done before in the history of the West.
Let me just stop you right there. Didn't the Netherlands legalize same-sex marriage as of 2001? I think they were the first to do it. And then obviously Massachusetts in 2003 argued it'll happen, and then it went into effect 2004. So it's not like it's not the very, very first time ever.
Right. Well, no, that's right. Well, I mean, 21st century. But look, you would need at least a couple generations of data, I would think, before you could even go ahead and make those assertions or you know, at least have some experimental examples. And look, gay marriage supporters that are listening right now will say, yeah, but there's been adoption by single parent families all the time of children. You know, that's something that's gone on. There have been kids raised in homes with just a mom, you know, so kids have been raised without mothers, without fathers. Yes, that's correct. But
is it ideal?
When that has happened, it's been usually the result of misfortune,
right?
Mistakes, of, you know, undesirable circumstances or outcomes. I mean, most single moms would prefer to be raising the kids with a husband.
Right.
And you know, they're heroic. They're doing great work. But what's so shocking about this is that for the first time ever, you have a nation as a matter of deliberate policy and law seeking to create a form of marriage that deliberately excludes either a mother or a father. And that's a shocking thing. And by the way, let me add that a lot of these kids that are going to be raised in these same-sex households, I'll even go so far as to say 20, 30, 40 years from now, they'll come forward and they'll probably say, look, I love my mom and my mom, or I love my dad and my dad. I'm sure they'll say that, but they'll probably have a big but. In a lot of cases, they'll say, but it would have been nice to have had a dad, right? It would have been nice to have had a mother. And of course it would. Everybody knows this.
Yeah.
But when your mind gets so poisoned by your ideology,
right. You
can't even think straight, and you kind of militate against common sense and experience. You're kind of rebelling against nature, let alone God.
Right.
And there again, that takes us back to the garden and back to the fall.
All right. Well, it's like somebody once said, a mother or a father, choose one. When it comes to same-sex marriage, that's what it boils down to. Now, you said a moment ago, a nation, as if this was the national decision. But, you know, Paul, you know as well as I do, this has been imposed on we the people through the courts. This has not been what we the people decided. Now, there have been a handful of states, three states, where the voters voted yes for same-sex marriage. But then there were about 30 where the voters said no. And so now these court decisions have trumped the will of the people. So it's not the will of the nation, you know, in one sense. And I don't know, what does this mean in terms of maybe disobeying the court?
Well, I think though the culture, Jerry, would have eventually gotten to this point anyway. In a way, there's a partial sense of relief that I don't have to spend the next 20 years waiting for the dreadful Supreme Court decision to come. I think the culture is moving in that way, that direction anyway, because the more you de-Christianize, the more you secularize, and the more that you think you can come up with your own definitions of anything, the more likely that this was going to happen. But look, this happened with Roe v. Wade, and I'm not surprised that Anthony Kennedy did this either, because in Kennedy's decision, Casey v. Planned Parenthood in 1992, upholding Roe v. Wade.
Yes.
Casey back then talked about how we all have it within our ability to come up with our own definitions of freedom, of liberty, and of life itself. Well, if you come up with your own definitions of life itself, actually, he used the word also existence in that decision. So if you can come up with your own individual relativistic definitions of existence, life itself, and liberty, then it would seem to me that your own definition of marriage is pretty much small potatoes.
Now, listen, I voted for Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan appointed Anthony Kennedy. He also appointed Justice Scalia, God bless him, but unfortunately also nominated Sandra Day O'Connor. But going back to Anthony Kennedy, and by the way, 100% of Kennedy's decisions haven't been bad, but this is certainly one of the really terrible ones he has given us. He's given us some terrible decisions in the past. So That rankles my spirit that, you know, we have, it reminds me of the old phrase from Pat Buchanan, conservative votes, liberal victory.
Right. Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. You know, if you look at the breakdown, though, the four of the five that voted for this were all appointed by liberals. So I guess the Republicans got pretty good on this. Four out of their five guys voted right on this question. I'll tell you what I think is more interesting, Jerry. Look at the religious breakdown of these folks. The four who voted to uphold marriage, Alito, Roberts, Scalia, and Thomas, are all very devout men. In fact, they're all very devout Catholics. And I know that Thomas, for example, is a daily mass goer.
Wow.
Alito is very religious. The five that voted against, however, Sotomayor was raised Roman Catholic. I don't think she practices anymore. No one even knows which church she belongs to.
If any.
Kennedy, and I've written on this for Catholic publications, we don't know what church Kennedy belongs to. We don't know how religious he is anymore. The other three, Kagan,
Jewish,
and Breyer and Ginsburg, are all non-religious secular Jews. They're ethnic Jews. They're not religious Jews. They're
right.
Not Orthodox Jews. So really, their breakdown, kind of the level of devoutness of these people, or lack thereof, very much reflects the position that they took on marriage.
Yeah, and it's interesting, in Scalia's dissent in this decision, he points out how nine lawyers came up with this decision and, you know, have made this ruling, nine lawyers. And he said that when you look at it, do we really represent the whole country? I mean, all nine of them went to two different law schools. That would be Yale and Harvard. You know, they're not representing the whole country. Now, part of that, I think, is because Christians, especially evangelicals, have abandoned politics for so long. We don't even have many that many good judges. You know, Roy Moore being a big exception. But still, this is an amazing thing. The court doesn't represent America, really, in a sense. I mean, they're not representative of, let's say, the flyover zone. Paul, what ramifications do you think this decision will have on religious liberty?
Oh, it's going to be devastating. It's going to be absolutely devastating because, I mean, look, we've seen what incredibly intolerant bullies, ironically in the name of tolerance and diversity, these gay marriage advocates are. I mean, they won't permit a baker or a florist or a photographer to just be left alone to not provide a service for one of their ceremonies if they disagree with it on religious bounds. Mm-hmm. They've been doing that in states like New Mexico, mm-hmm. Oregon, Colorado, all over the place. Now imagine, Jerry, they're going to be going to those same florists and bakers and everybody else and saying, not only do I have a right to get married, I have a constitutional right to get married. How dare you deny me my constitutional rights? So you know, they're going to have, this gives them an even bigger club to wield. And, you know, for haters of Christianity and organized religion, and here again, I go back to the larger ideological history that the communist movement has so long hated religion. What Kennedy and these folks have done has been just a magnificent tool. They have given these folks a club to pound religious believers, unlike they've ever pounded them before. And so for the Christian, we're going to spend the rest of our lives trying to support and fight for our religious rights as these people run roughshod with their new, brand newly invented constitutional right to gay marriage.
You know, I hate to even hear the word constitution be thrown around because this has nothing to do with the Constitution. In fact, Chief Justice Roberts even read a dissent, which apparently this is the first time he's ever done that. And in the dissent, he said, hey, you may support this decision. You may be gay. You may be appreciative. Or you may be friendly to that. Whatever. You celebrate all you want, but don't think this has anything to do with the Constitution. And that's absolutely correct.
Well, neither does Roe v. Wade, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Roe v. Wade's got nothing to do with the Constitution, but they invented a penumbra, and within a penumbra, they found a right to privacy that didn't exist, and within that right to privacy, they read in a right to an abortion, despite at least a couple different mentions elsewhere in the Constitution of not a right to abortion or a right to privacy, but a right to life.
Now, this is interesting.
They do whatever they want.
They did that in 1973. Here we are in the year of our Lord, 2015. Is abortion a settled issue in America?
Well, unfortunately, the legal right to it is. And what's been settled is that they've aborted over 50 million babies have been aborted in the process.
That's true.
So, maybe if I could give any encouragement at all on this day, it would be, the hard lesson that, the Christians have learned through abortion, which is you might not ever be able to reverse this legally speaking, although you will have to constantly fight to try to make sure that it doesn't get worse. But, you know, a lot of this is going to be simply getting back to ministry, gospel, talking to people one-on-one, and just saying, forget about America, forget about the Constitution, forget about the judges, forget about the law. They're not with us. But, you know, we are ultimately residents and citizens of a higher world. And in that higher world, no matter what five people on the Supreme Court say, Jerry, marriage is still, according to nature and nature's God, it is still the bond between one man and one woman.
All right, we're talking right now with Dr. Paul Kanger. We're finishing up here as we discuss this issue of the Supreme Court and its recent decision on gay marriage. And Dr. Kanger has written the book called Takedown. What was the subtitle of the book?
From Communists to Progressives, How the Left Has Sabotaged Family and Marriage.
Boy, talk about
ironic
the sabotage.
Title, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. Talk about sabotage. Okay, there is a question I had asked earlier, and I don't remember what your response is. So it was Reagan who gave us Anthony Kennedy. Your comment on that.
Yeah, it was. It was Reagan who gave us Anthony Kennedy. He thought he had a conservative. I wrote a whole book on Judge William Clark, who knew Kennedy very well, and Clark was closer to Reagan than anybody else. And I knew Clark very well. He became like a grandfather to me. And Clark used to have weekly lunches with Anthony Kennedy when they were both judges in Sacramento. Clark was on the California Supreme Court, and Kennedy was on the federal court in Sacramento. They were both Irish Catholic upbringings, and I remember, Jerry, that Bill Clark told me. He said he said Anthony Kennedy is he said he's pro-life. He's also fairly conservative. He is a Republican. He said, but be wary of this with Kennedy. He said he's very, very influenced by his immediate surroundings and the people around him. And so Clark was always worried about what would happen to Kennedy in places like Washington and on issues like this. And, you know, Clark died two years ago, August of 2013. And, I've been thinking about him a lot today. And he's, I won't say he's rolling over in his grave because he probably wouldn't be surprised. He'd be disappointed, but he wouldn't be surprised.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You just said that he was talking about Anthony Kennedy, that he was pro-life. And yet in the Casey decision that you referenced earlier, 1992, that's when the court actually had the opportunity to overturn Roe v. Wade, and they didn't. And it was because of Anthony Kennedy. Now, by the way, let me just say this in vindication of Ronald Reagan. He did nominate Judge Robert Bork. The left pulled out all stops, lied about that man, even gave us a word in the English dictionary to bork someone, sabotage them with a barrage of lies. Then after Bork's nomination went down in flames, then they nominated somebody named Ginsburg.
Ginsburg?
Yeah, not to be confused with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but a person who had smoked pot or something in college, and that disqualified him. It didn't disqualify Bill Clinton for running for president, but that's because
he
didn't
live in Colorado where it's legal.
Well, and also because he didn't inhale, and that's the difference. Okay. All right. We need a closing thought here on this this subject of same-sex marriage. Where do we go from here? How do we give us some hope to kind of, you know, finish up on?
Well, the churches have to, of course, hold the line and stay true to their faith. And all of us now need to fight to try to preserve religious liberty, to you know, try not only to keep the gay marriage brigades and the liberals from going after churches and clergy and ministers and so forth, but from going after Christian business owners. You know, we need to defend that Baptist grandma who says, I've never discriminated against gay people. I even have some working for me, and I've served them for years. But I draw the line when it comes to making a cake for a wedding that blasphemes my God. We need to defend that person. And I'm telling you, we're going to be in defensive mode for a long, long, long time, because now five people on the Supreme Court just invented a constitutional right to gay marriage.
Isn't that something? You know, let me close with this thought. In fact, this may be somebody near and dear to your own heart, because I know you're a Catholic. There was the leader of the Catholics in Chicago who made a very interesting statement a few years ago before he died, but he said something to this effect: I expect to die in my bed. And by the way, he did die in his bed about 2 months ago or so. He said,
Cardinal Francis George.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then he went on to say, I expect that my successor will die in prison, and I expect that his successor will die as a martyr in the public square. Now, those words were said in 2010. Who could have thought of martyrdom in America. But, you know, when you have this fierce anti-Christian force out there, you know, that in the name of tolerance, you know, we tolerate everything except, you know, unless you don't tolerate our lifestyle and celebrate it, you know, then we're going to come after you. It's just
well, and Jerry,
shocking.
They're convinced that we're not just wrong in our position against redefining marriage. They're convinced that we're evil. And when they're convinced of that, look out for what they might do to you.
You know, that isn't that interesting? When you think about humanity, the history of humanity, whenever one group will dehumanize another group, like call them evil or whatever, then eventually that can lead to all kinds of mischief and even killings. And I mean, Hitler and the Nazis, they redefined, you know, who was human, who should live, who should not. You know, they were trying to speed up evolution, and they looked at the Jews as this cunning race that needed to be, you know, removed from humanity, and the gypsies were inferior and they had to be taken away, etc. And this leads to, you know, real bloodshed. I mean, it's amazing.
Well, that's why Cardinal George said what he said. And a lot of liberals, including a lot of liberal Catholics, oh, come on, this is over the top. What hyperbole.
We've been talking right now with Dr. Paul Kanger. Again, the name of his book is Takedown. And Paul, how about a concluding thought on this whole subject of same-sex marriage and the Supreme Court's recent decision?
Well, it's a stunning day. I mean, June 26, 2015, it took a long time before a group of people came along and redefined God's plan and nature's design, God's design for marriage. But in this absolutely stunning, literally completely unprecedented development in the history of this country with Judeo-Christian roots, Americans today have finally taken the step, the incredible, incredibly audacious step of rendering unto themselves the definition of what constitutes marriage. It's an amazing thing.
Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Jerry.